And as an odd consequence, not much longer after, humans started to arise and beat the crap out of elves. Guess killing and eating your protector deity was not a good idea. Welcome to Worldcasting, where we discuss real, made-up things. I'm your host, Tyler, and today you'll be joining me in a discussion on The Elder Scrolls, which is the popular setting of games such as in Skyrim, Oblivion, and Morrowind. Today joining me are Immaculate and Red, if you'd be so kind as to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I am Immaculate, also known as Ionar Natividad. I'm the editorial chair here at Worldbuilding Magazine and a freelance writer and editor. I love worldbuilding, gaming, and a lot of this fantasy stuff, and I'm really glad to be here.
Hi, I'm Red. I've been on this podcast a few times now, and I'm one of Immaculate's editing lackeys. I am also a huge fan of Elder Scrolls. I've been playing this series for forever, and I'm actually super excited that we're going to talk about it today.
As am I.
Yay! Fosroda!
Okay, no, you can leave. That's the bad one.
Skyrim had lore. Come on, guys. Didn't you ever read the journals?
Hey, as much as you want to bag on it, Skyrim plays well.
Oh, it plays so smooth. That game is like freaking butter on silk. Like, everything's just fluid.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's so hard to go back to the old games, which is, like, sad because they're also really good.
Yeah, and then I love the story and lore in all of them. And it's funny, though, speaking of going back, because what really kind of I just love about the Elder Scrolls is how inconsistent they are game to game with their own background. Like in the very first one, Arena, there weren't like Argonians were like silver skinned humans, which later become the background race, the Kothringi. But it was such a different world. Like orcs weren't playable; they were just monsters. And as they kind of continued on into the present, when you had Daggerfall and Redguard and Morrowind, etc., up to Skyrim. Like, there's just little pieces, and then they manipulate it to create, like, a bridge. Like, Daggerfall ends one of, like, 30 different ways, and then they somehow made all the endings canon.
Yeah, and I'm not gonna lie, the way they did it is, like, super smart. It's, like, cover your butt kind of tactics, but, like, it's cleverly done.
And it And it only used like lore and ideas put forward in the game. So it's not even like they kind of retconned it.
Because what is it they call that thing? It's the Dragon Rend or something like that.
The Dragon Break, the Warp in the West.
Yes, yes. So cool. It's a clever idea. It's funny because, you know, every now and then you'll find these moments where people go against the rules. But this is that age-old adage of if you know the rules, you can break them sometimes. I think in this scenario, it was a let's cover our butts moment, like I just said. But it was well enough done that it's like they're like, well, we've backed ourselves into a corner. Let's just like quickly work something in here that fits the lore that we're already trying to keep true to, but also gives us the capacity to break free from that every now and then if we need to. It's kind of the same thing that comic books do with their concept of, oh, this is actually Earth, you know, 236. It's a clever way of kind of just saying that there are branches, but what is really neat about it, the way that they've worked it into Elder Scrolls lore, is that at some point those timelines flow back into each other again.
So rather than a branch per se, it's more like a weave of sorts, where one string kind of twists and turns for a bit, but ultimately just kind of entangles with another timeline. Daggerfall was one of the games I really couldn't get into, so I never finished it, unfortunately. However, I am more familiar with kind of the apocalyptic endings to the succeeding games, like Morrowind and Oblivion, and how they kind of play into the lore for the other games, but they're never really, what's the best word for it? They make an appearance, but it's not usually like direct. Does that make sense?
It's more like an Easter egg almost than an actual tie-in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think one of the draws of the whole series is that each game is kind of standalone. Like, it doesn't require the previous one to know its story. Mm-hmm. It just helps you understand the lore a little bit better.
Yeah, it's the world that kind of grows over time. It's not so much the story, which is a nice thing. It makes it super accessible. I mean, sometimes it makes it creepily accessible. I remember Skyrim came out when I was in high school, and people were, golly, that makes me sound so much younger than I actually am. But it's true. I don't know. That's not important right now. Anywho, Skyrim came out while I was in high school. But the crazy thing about it was, like, you had everyone playing that game. I mean, nerds and jocks alike. It was just super accessible. The gameplay was great. It was coming out, you know, in the hype of the constantly growing Microsoft Sony war, and so it was one of those kinds of games that everyone could enjoy because it wasn't exclusive. But it wasn't exclusive just for consoles. It wasn't an exclusive for the story either, and that is something that works super well in Elder Scrolls' favor. And it's really fun.
Yeah, I definitely think that the accessibility of it is always what's been, like, one of the main draws for when people say why they love it, just because it's so easy to get into. And unlike a lot of games, which I find kind of either rubs its lore in your face, or in the case of something like Dragon Age, where it's all neatly put together for you and at your leisure, go look at it. Or Destiny, where you want to pretend that there's lore here, you have to go on the internet to find it because we put it there and nowhere else. It's
Well, I think the other interesting thing too, because you just drew the quick comparison to Dragon Age and stuff like that, is like the main difference between these two, you know, behemoth titles is in Skyrim, for instance, you aren't required to have at least some sort of like, you don't have to pay that much attention to like the lore of the world, even just what's progressing in the game. Whereas in Dragon Age, you kind of have to be aware of who's doing what to who so that you know where the story is going. Skyrim is just so open and so detached from the lore in a way that, again, its accessibility is, I can't think of another game that really quite matches it for having as expansive a world as it does, but still choosing to be, let's just, you know, let people have fun in this game. You know, let them go do whatever the heck they want.
Yeah, it's a lot more pick and choosy. Like, I'm thinking of how you kind of describe it as detached from the lore. Simultaneously, I don't think it's necessarily detached. It's not as in your face, but like I said, it just gives you a lot more freedom to pick what parts you want to involve yourself in. Some might say that they kind of did water down the writing for quest lines in order to make it more easier to follow. For example, I remember my favorite quest line in Skyrim would always be the Thieves Guild. I think that was one of the better played out, better written quest lines, although it was also still pretty, at a certain point you could telegraph what was going to happen. But when you compare that to something like the quest lines in Oblivion for the Thieves Guild, or even Morrowind, there's a distinct kind of there's a change in how they handled the lore and the writing. It's not necessarily a bad change for accessibility, or it's not necessarily a bad change overall. It just made it, as Red's been putting, a lot more accessible, easier to follow. You could put down the game and probably pick it back up and you'd remember what's going on. Whereas, let's say in Oblivion and you were like pretty deep into the Thieves Guild quest, I don't know if I should spoil anything with them. With who you meet and kind of the end goal. But essentially, if you kind of left alone for a week or two, you might just forget details that might actually be vital to your completion of the quest. And in Skyrim, it's pretty guided, perhaps as part of the design, the UI, but still.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair assumption. I did feel like Skyrim was definitely more guided in everything it tried to do to kind of just make it easier for everyone to understand what was going on. And I think in some areas they sacrificed a little bit too much, like the Civil War quest line, which could easily have been like one of the drawing points. They kind of scrapped a lot of it, and it kind of ended up being this like hollow facsimile of itself that didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, the minute you said watered down and Machina, like the first thing that popped in my mind was like basically the Civil War quest, which, by the way, I have still not actually legitimately finished.
It's okay. Spoiler, when you finish it for the Imperials, your reward is an unenchanted sword.
I had expectations for that Civil War quest. I don't know why, or I don't know how I expected them to be filled, but I definitely thought there'd be a bit more, there'd be more kind of, I want to say, politics, maybe a bit of intrigue. Not like you have to, like, because it's like when you have dialogue choices, like they've been kind of setting you up for throughout the game. It's like, oh, maybe they do something cool here and you can either diplomats. No, there's really just one way. You can never complete that quest. And it's the most direct way. It's same as diving into a dungeon filled with Draugr.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at one point you do dive into a dungeon filled with Draugr.
Somehow.
Just one time. Only once.
I'm surprised it's only the one time.
Speaking, like going back to this main point of there being inconsistencies in the lore too, I think another thing that is really nice that they play into with that, and this is kind of a jump, a big jump back, but one of the other things I really love about the inconsistencies in the lore is that they also kind of play with that as being inconsistencies in historical retellings of things. I guess I can't necessarily say that all of their circumstances where there are ambiguous parts of the lore are also inconsistencies, but there are some scenarios where they do blend over. But I have to say that, like, one of my favorite, I don't know if this is an inconsistency, I guess I'd have to go look this up, but it is at the very least an ambiguity, is like the Seichi, who, you know, maybe like Naga people who are running the Akavir continent for all we know, or maybe they're actually just regular people, or maybe they, you know, maybe they're just puppet masters for a bunch of human being like people, and people are like, there are secretly snake people running this country.
Oh, and they're possibly vampires.
Yes, exactly. It's like, there are some cool things where it's like, in a world where communication is not instantaneous, which is something we take for granted all the darn time, there are all sorts of rumors and stuff like that. Well, heck, I mean, even in our modern world, there are still rumors of things even with instantaneous and, you know, communication, all that stuff. But like, there are rumors and stuff like that. They're like, wow, this country's run by snake people. You know, I've got a brother who came back from, or I got a great uncle who came back from that war. Talked about how, you know, there were snake people everywhere. He couldn't look at a snake his whole life. And it's just like, it's really interesting because it's one of those things that gives an air of mysticism to a world that is, you know, at this point kind of familiar because of how entrenched in Tolkien-esque vibes it is. It's kind of fun to see them play with some of these potential things that they may never answer that are just kind of fun to speculate on.
It is definitely cool how they treat Akavir. And to everyone who says Akavir is going to be a game someday, it's not. It's just not.
No, it never will, which kind of breaks my heart because it'd be tons of fun to explore. But at the same time, too, I'd also be disappointed with anything they threw at me. Again, the mysticism behind it is kind of fun.
There's like this one book, The Disaster at Ioneth, I believe it's called. And it just details how the Imperials tried to invade Akavir like a couple hundred years before Oblivion. And they just like were doing okay. And then spring came and they found out that the Saeshi were all, you know, in aestivation torpor or whatever. And they all just come flooding out and overrun them. And there's just a horde of snake men that they have no chance of beating. And then they have to go back home after they lose like half their force. And it's just like, if I go there to Akavir and I don't fight a horde of snake men that have just thawed out, I'd be very disappointed.
Yep.
I think you just jinxed it. Now they're definitely going to make an Akavir game.
I mean, that one mountain looked like it could be in this biome. And oh, God, that trailer for that teaser, that picture of a mountain with the words Elder Scrolls 6 over it. Yes, because that couldn't be literally any of the biomes in the entirety of the continent or world.
Well, they've been pretty at least consistent at trying to explore something new each time. There's a lot of speculation over where 6 is going to be held, but considering just like kind of the span and the expanse, I wouldn't mind seeing it done. I hope done well, all things considered, but I wouldn't count it out.
My personal feelings for it is you're probably going to get a Hammerfell game or probably Valenwood / Elsweyr game, because I don't think either one alone has enough content for a whole game, but together they'd be pretty cool.
Haven't they done Elsweyr with Elder Scrolls Online?
Yeah, but
Elder Scrolls, they've done everywhere with Elder Scrolls Online at this point.
Yeah,
and it's Elder Scrolls Online. Ugh.
I mean, they, granted,
which
though,
I only just recently learned was set in the past. It is the earliest game in the entry, chronologically speaking, which I did not know.
I just want something new, honestly. I don't want them reusing assets. Maybe that's it. Please don't reuse assets. Every game and try to sell it to people.
Don't forget, the main boss of 76 was a dragon model reformed. Okay. So I think from here we will dive into exploring a little bit about this and kind of just, it's been a little of us just talking about Elder Scrolls, about what we like about it. And from here, I'd like to kind of focus in a little bit more and talk about a few of the key concepts about Elder Scrolls as a setting and kind of just talk about what's interesting and how they approached it. And the first thing I'd like to do is talk about the dichotomy they have between the provinces on Tamriel, which is the main continent where the games take place, and the provinces they're in, where each province has its own unique race, and they're each centered there, but there is mixture and some races going across borders, etc., like in the real world. So it's pretty interesting to see. And there are 9 provinces in total, with a 10th fake province for the orcs, who got kind of shoehorned in at the last minute. The 10 provinces are the Somerset Isles, Valenwood, Morrowind, High Rock, Cyrodiil, Skyrim, Hammerfell, Orsinium, which is the fake province, Elsweyr, and Blackmarsh. And what's kind of interesting is that they all kind of form this wheel of sorts around the central province, which is Cyrodiil, which is like the heartland. And they all are kind of tied to their direct neighbors, which is really cool. And then Cyrodiil stands both alone and connected to them all. It's kind of a refreshing approach where, yeah, there's the one big empire that rules the continent trope, but it ties it all together by giving each province its own flair and its own people to live there that then can show like the color and flavor of that region just by being who they are.
Yeah, and they do a really good job of, in the handful of games that we've gotten and things like that, we've seen some really cool cultural differences between them. I mean, even in Skyrim alone, when you get to go and play the DLCs, you get to see these different architectural styles even and things like that, which are just really fun to observe. I don't think any game, though, has done it quite as good as Oblivion did, because Oblivion, you know, Cyrodiil's right in the smack dab middle of everything, like you said. And each corner of Cyrodiil's kind of got that, like you said, they're in a wheel, so they've kind of got that that flair in each corner of the countries that are nearby. And I love that was probably my favorite thing about Oblivion, was to be able to see those cultural aspects kind of play out a little bit visually, at least in just one of the games, as opposed to, you know, like them having to offer me an entire Tamriel in order to see that.
Yeah, I think the game did really well in acknowledging the fact that divisions and kind of geopolitical boundaries are geopolitical boundaries. That's just because people decided it. But the cultures themselves, and of course the aesthetic, is going to blend because there's going to be people that interact in between the two of them. And I think that's something in kind of world building, games, books, that we don't always get, partly because it's a lot of work, I think, from a writing perspective, to inherently convey that. But when you have something like a game as a medium, you can simply show it once you've established, of course, some predetermined lore regarding both sides. So it becomes easier to show the product of borrowing from both aesthetics and putting into something that's distinctly similar, but probably memorable in its own.
Even to touch back on the inconsistencies, some of the things that they've said in the past about provinces didn't always ring out true. And sometimes it's for the worse. Like in Skyrim, one of the cities, Falkreath, is like a collection of hovels, pretty much, where it's previously stated it had been one of like these massive cities.
Yeah.
And it was important to a lot of the history and background of the Empire forming.
That was a disappointment for me. I remember going there and I was not impressed after hearing people mentioning it, or just like kind of occasionally seeing, like, oh, this is cool. It's supposed to be a major city because it like shows up on your map. It's like, oh, okay. And it's just there.
It's like 5 huts with straw roofs.
I think there was some important quest in there, but it's been a while since I played, like, for the completionist route of getting all the quests done.
Oh, Falgrith actually has some of my favorite.
But as an aside to the other half of this dichotomy is, Cyrodiil itself was shown in Oblivion as this, like, lush, verdant woodland with fields, idyllic mountains. Very Britain stretched over a much longer, much nicer biome.
Yeah.
And in everything else, it kind of was alluded and said that Cyrodiil was a jungle.
Right.
Yeah. The area around the big lake where the Imperial City is a mangrove swamp. And they used to be like these wild elves that lived there that the Roman-esque Imperials like slaughtered and took over, and they were the masters of the jungle, but Roman. And you go there and you're like, okay, what's going on? Because this is not what I was promised in previous games. And they go back to say that when Talos, who was the founder of the Empire and ascended to godhood, his gift to his people was that he changed the past and turned the jungle into forest and plains so his people could live there in harmony, peace, and prosperity.
And no one can really disprove it, technically.
Yeah, and the thing is that with this would be one of those dragon breaks where time kind of went wonky and something messed up. And it's funny because like some characters are supposed to remember, like really old characters, like, hey, that's not right. Like there's an affirmative date of when things shifted over and you're like, So it's funny to see the ramifications of using even your own inconsistency to shape the lore and have reactions to it.
I think those old people just realize it's too much time and energy to try to convince people otherwise. So they just stay quiet for their own sanity.
Yeah, pretty much. So you have like this really cool way that they kind of built things together, and it's patchwork in some areas, and in others, it's this just really neat flair that pieces it together where you're left asking questions is this real or is this just like what people say happened? Like,
right.
There's a couple of them that are just really strange. Like, there's a hero to the humans, Pelennil Whitestrake, a crusader who freed them from the slavery of the elves. And there's some lore that just says that he was just this, like, half-Adric, this half-spirit person that went around forever helping men learn to free themselves and fight and found kingdoms and then leave them to the rulings of other people to go and free more people. And then there's other lore that says that he was a cyborg sent from the past future to stop the elves from destroying reality. And it's just kind of like this. I'm reading the book in my 10th grade English class, and she says that there's symbology here in these words, and I don't see it, but I'm just going to believe her kind of moment. And it's just kind of cool to see how even the fans can form their own opinions as to what's real in these situations. So, moving on just a bit, I wanted to talk about the different races because it has this really neat approach of being kind of part Tolkien, part D&D, part we evolved over 20 years and we made this our own.
Yeah, and that kind of stuff we'll explain here in a moment, I guess. But like, it is kind of fun to see how those two inform the countries that they are that they claim are their homelands. Normally, I'd be like, it's not very realistic to say that, like, this is the homeland for these cat people. They have only ever lived here, nowhere else. They don't get out very often. But, like, in this, it's a fun concept. But, I mean, to be fair, the games do an okay job of showing that cultures and species have spread out. So, I mean, it's really not that bad. It's well played is what I'm trying to get at.
And I like that they have a focus as to how they've had relations in the past with each other, depending on who their neighbors are and how you get to places. Morrowind, which is home to the Dark Elves, is right next to Blackmarsh, home of the Argonian Lizardmen. And the Dark Elves have traditionally been a united people, and the Argonians, not so much. The Dark Elves have tended to come raid them, enslave them, conquer them, and take them back en masse. And then Elder Scrolls Online randomly forgive them and decide to ally with them.
They've changed.
See, I can't speak too much for Elder Scrolls Online. Not played it. Have not read too much about the lore that they put in there. Again, I just recently discovered this morning that it's one of the chronologically earliest games in the series.
Yeah, like the main prequel.
It's pretty. I'll give it that. It's actually really pretty, and it makes some of the towns look really cool. But anyways, so you have this kind of spillover between different areas where they kind of, yeah, it's, there are only Argonians in Blackmarsh, you say, until you look at the edges and you have Dark Elves and Khajiit and some Imperials. There's actually a city, Stormhold, I believe it's called, in Northern Blackmarsh, which is actually controlled and run by Imperials. And there was a phone game that was kind of run there. I think it's a Shadow Key. And it, you know, it's just minor things like that where there's just this random fortress city on the border between the where men live and where lizard people live. And there's mostly men living there despite it being in lizard people territory. It's not as cut and dry as a lot of D&D or you'll see created settings from people online where it's like only X lives here. And if they are, there is, it's like just a couple people living there that are not the race that lives here. And each place has its own story as to how not only their nation was formed, but how the world was formed. And they have a bunch of books in game that kind of explore this in detail. And it's one of the coolest parts of the setting, reading how the Imperials and Nords, because they have such a close kinship, their stories are really similar with a few details, like a dragon that eats the world, which ended up being true. And then you have some like the Red Guards, who are totally out there and different, and they have this whole page, this whole pantheon with the Hunding and Tall Papa and all these things. That's like this mix of Africana and Caribbean folklore that kind of folds together into, of all things, Japanese sword honor,
mm-hmm.
to make one of the coolest races in the series.
Yeah, and they even play the middle ground, too, with the Khajiit, who have this sort of pantheon that pulls from just about everyone else's and has their own explanations for how cat people came to be in comparison to everyone else and why they're better than everyone else, too, despite the fact that they are spat on by pretty much everybody. It's really fun to see that take on things because we can see those kind of religious similarities in real-world religions. It's not something that people like to talk about very often because it's largely speculation, because religion goes back farther than we can trace most of the time. But we are aware, though, of there being these vast similarities that kind of say that there is some sort of root to religion. And to see Elder Scrolls play with that idea that there are certain religions that are based or at least have similarities to another, if that's just in pantheons that have very similar names. I mean, just go look up some of the names of the regular pantheon, compare them to the Khajiit pantheon, and you'll see there's a lot of crazy similarities there. That in that same vein, they are a mixture of a couple others. They have Daedric Princes, for instance, who some of the pantheons are part of some of the pantheons for some of these races. And it's kind of something that you don't really see all that often. I find that in a lot of fiction and stuff like that, we have these very singular and secluded religious settings. It's like everyone pretends that there's like only one religion in the universe, and you either are, you know, with it or an atheist. And it's nice to see a setting that actually tries and plays religion in a very realistic and very intriguing from world building standpoint kind of way.
I think the what you mentioned, kind of the, this is one religion and this is how it's supposed to be. If you're from here, this is how you should believe in so and so. Everyone else is wrong. I think that's the idea of creating distinct religions, or rather distinguishing this one area or this one people, this one culture from someone else. It gets done a lot because I think it's probably the easiest way to do distinctions. However, what I really enjoyed hearing from Red is the Khajiit's kind of that cross-cultural take to them. And it even matches up with the fact that there's like a, there's those jokes about the Khajiits constantly traveling, but that is utterly reflective of why their culture is probably how it is, how they're pulling from these different places, because traders, travelers go out there. They don't just perpetuate their own ideas, but they absorb ideas back. And in the tales that they bring back, the whatever goods, experiences, that gets folded into the local, the native, kind of the native lore, the native narrative that ultimately becomes their history, their beliefs, kind of being shaped over an accumulation of experiences and travels.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you pointed that out for me. That is one of the really cool things about Elsewhere, the Khajiit homeland, is if you go and you look at their history, they have just been in political turmoil forever. And so they've been invaded by everybody. They've made treaties with everybody throughout history. And so not only do the Khajiit themselves travel and get and bring back these cultural bits and pieces that have probably informed their own, but because of how diverse their leadership has been throughout history, that has infected their homeland as well. And so it's really cool the amount of thought that they've put into the Elder Scrolls lore as far as religions and cultures go. It is probably some of the most dynamic world building I have seen in both of those areas in a long time. I mean, lore inconsistencies aside, they've done a really good job of fleshing that stuff out and taking into account what all that would affect.
And I think that goes back to that the Dragon Wren that was mentioned, these multiple possibilities for how it all disperses as far as timelines are concerned, events are concerned, but then also kind of connects back from kind of slightly separating from the lore and the narrative. You can even connect that to the fact that these are games being published years apart, being created, developed, written years apart by different, often different teams. So it's like covering your butt, future-proofing essentially for possible inconsistencies that just like keeps cropping up, which is impressive when you can make those connections. But simultaneously, I think it's important to remember that not everyone who started with one game will be still on the same project or projects in the near future. There might be intersections, but it's a fun way that they've managed to turn collaboration. They've managed to kind of cover one of the possible weaknesses of a continuous setting, and possibly one of the pitfalls of a collaborated work is that you will have points where not everyone had the same idea for this piece of lore. But if we cover ourselves, say this is a possibility, then you can get away with it. But people thinking, oh, it's just, you know, in game or in world, that makes sense because no one really knows.
And it breeds this odd bit of credence to when some things line up. Like, you just have these moments in the lore where two people are saying the exact same thing about an event. You go, oh no. A great one that comes to mind is in the background. Some of the early elves, they were sick of worshiping the real gods, and they wanted to worship their edgy, evil demon gods, who are the good ones. Don't worry, they're the three good ones, but they're still evil demons. the Daedra. And they decide to leave. And to stop them, one of the good elven gods comes, Trinimac, the champion of the elven pantheon. Defender, who has been keeping and oppressing all other people down. And Trinimac goes to stop the Velothi with all of his people, who are these, like, pariahs who swear their life to Trinimac. And the people leaving pray to their evil demon gods. I mean, they're three good Daedra. And one of them answers, I believe it's Boethia, who is a lord of battle and a lot of other things. And Boethia fights Trinimac and eats him. And then, I am not kidding you, craps him out as the new Daedric lord. Oh my god, I just had his name in my head, and then it got replaced with Molag Bol. Malakath.
Now I'm blanking on it too. Yeah, there you go.
And I kid you not, god, he craps him out into the new Daedric lord, Malakath, lord of outcasts, pariahs, and the fallen, and all of Trinimac's people turn into the Orsimer, the pariah folk, the orcs. And then they get to the these nice, good dark elves get to go and become the Dunmer. And, you know, it's all history since then. But orcs agree. Malekith agrees. Boethia agrees. The dark elves agree. And the high elves agree that that actually happened. And as an odd consequence, not much longer after, humans started to arise and beat the crap out of elves. I guess killing and eating your protector deity was not a good idea.
No. You know, there is another really fascinating thing since we're on the subject of deity that I've also been fascinated by, and that is playing both sides of the present gods and not present gods coin. You have the Aedra, who are, you know, typically seen as like, you know, the normal gods, the actual true deity, and then you have the Daedra, who are essentially demons. But like the fascinating thing is to see that the Aedra like do not get involved in anything. Their only influence comes through some, you know, very occasional small miracles, and then the blessings you can get at their altars. But then you have the Daedra, who are like, this is a sandbox. You better believe I'm playing with this thing. Much like our players are. If, you know, maybe that there's a fun theory for you. Your Elder Scrolls, you're actually playing a Daedra controlling a hero the whole time. But it's just, it's really cool to see that that play out too, because in fiction, you have the ability to have your divinity, you know, very present, unlike we do in reality. You know, depending on your beliefs, whereas you know you can play it the other way, where you have divinity that are constantly hands off and very similar to what people think does happen in reality. And it's fun to see them, and this may have just been another, like Imaginate said, a result of collaboration, that someone said, I want to have it this way, and someone said, no, I want to have it this way, and they said, well, what happens if we have it both ways? Have one set of gods who does nothing and another set of gods who just like to experiment. And it has led to some of the best quests and some of the best background stories. Just like you were saying, Tyler, there's some really cool historical stories that come out of those things too, out of the involvement of these deity.
And it's cool to see when they tie it all kind of together. I know in Oblivion, one of its DLCs, the Knights of the Nine, one of the main enemy of it, Umaril, the Unfettered, is one of the servants of the Daedric Lord, Meridia. And just kind of seeing her interaction with how she used to interact with the Aeliads and all these other things. And it all kind of ties together to show that there's always been kind of this fight between those who worship Aedra and those who worship Daedra, going back to when elves enslaved humans thousands and thousands of years ago. And on top of that, there's cool little things that they seed into people's backstories with just why do they do what they do? Like, why does Meridia like the elves so much? I mean, she's a goddess of, or demoness of killing undead. Like, that's kind of blanketing. But the thing is that she has a lot to do with magic, and in her backstory, she's tied into these beings called the Magna Gii, who are like Aedra, but they decided to leave reality and explode a hole open, creating the sun to retain being real gods. And she was one of them, but for consorting with the Daedra, they cast her down into being one. And now she just kind of walks around still trying to do good stuff and give people magic, except people see her as an evil demon goddess now. And it's just kind of cool.
Wait, this is Meridia?
Yeah, Meridia, yep.
Oh, who am I thinking of? That's, I was getting her mixed up with the, Azura?
Azura, yep.
Yeah, sorry, I thought it was like, Meridia is like the light girl woman. It's like, no, it's the other one. Okay, good. Yeah, I remember now. Mm.
Well, no, you're right. Meridia is technically the light person. You're thinking of the Break of Dawn from Skyrim, where you get her beacon in a random treasure chest. And then you get that really creepy and annoying, a new hand touches the beacon, you know, announcement that still to this day, you know, gives me nightmares.
Oh, yes. All the Daedric princes are pretty much one measure of evil.
I think you're just mixing them all together.
Yeah, I think I'm just mixing up the Aedra and the Daedra at this point. Like, no, it's the Daedra. No, all the Daedras are kind of assholes. I just remember. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It doesn't matter where it's like light or not. She's a Daedra. Okay.
But, you know, it's all right. Again, even the people who are in charge of this lore get it mixed up sometimes, too. So, you know, it's okay.
If anything, Keller's sworn enemy or vampires, but if you were a vampire, you can actually interact with her.
It is one of those interesting things, too, where on a more technical side, you can't help but wonder what how much of this is like the product of things that they did not intend, which you got to believe this being such a large effort over the past, you know, 30 years. There's got to be quite a bit of lore in here that they're like, well, we didn't really intend for that to happen, but we accidentally put it in. So let's just roll with it, see what happens. It's one of those really neat things where it's kind of cool as a content creator to see those kinds of things happen and realize that that's okay. I mean, most of the time people see it as a cheap trick to just kind of roll with your own punches. But it's also really fascinating, though, because sometimes it feels like legitimate inspiration to have those things pop up and you're like, well, you know, it's in there. How can I work with it? It's really nice to see that there is a method to taming madness. So if you ever find yourself in a scenario where you've accidentally world-built yourself into a place where you're like, oh, this is not where I wanted to be, before you like consider just tossing out the window, consider like what would happen if you left it in there. What implications would that have, and how would that play out in a story on its own?
And that's where having other people either playing in your world or looking at it really matters or really helps, because you can be like, oh, so this connects to so-and-so, and that's why they're so-and-so. And it's like, exactly. That's right. Great.
Yep.
I'm going to use that.
And I imagine, having not played very many tabletop games ever in my life, I imagine that that's kind of another nice thing to be playing with other people. Because, you know, not everything correlates between how video games and RPGs and tabletop RPGs work. But I imagine that that's where it's kind of nice to have someone else at the table to say, oh, you know, this is where we're drawing this connection. And you're like, oh, that's very interesting. I'm going to write this down and not say anything. And that's something, too, that we're that I've encountered a couple times. Tyler and I are working on a collaborative world project together. And I can't say that we've reached this point yet where, you know, we're like, well, that's a happy accident. But there are some times, though, where it's nice to have that other person to bounce ideas off of. And whether that person responds or not, like you said, most of the time it's a player who's catching these things and is speculating on it. But it is just kind of nice to have another another wall, I guess, to throw those ideas off of. You can come up with some really cool things that way.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's also where, not to say there's necessarily debate about it, there is a kind of a talk about the size of the world and, of course, the depth of world building. You can get away with this more when you've...
Part to be edited out just behind maybe 10 seconds.
I had politicians are calling my home state because their primary election's happening very soon.
Tis the season.
So, shoot, where was I? Okay, well, let's redo that. I'm not trying to say there's like necessarily a debate to it, but I think that's also where kind of the merits of world building size as well as world building depth come into play. It's easier to leave bits of those inconsistencies, or rather those gaps, not necessarily inconsistencies, those gaps for other people to fill in when you do have either a larger world or kind of a deeper levels of lore into it. When you kind of only have, what's the best way to put it? When you only have kind of one string, like almost like a road, like a railroad, some would say, that you can follow, it makes it very stringent and kind of difficult to leave ambiguity. And that's when perhaps inconsistencies are more likely to be noticed because there's not room for it. And that's fine too, because sometimes histories and events, chronologies are just that. That's what happened, so and so. But more often than not, actual histories will have depth to it. And so leaving behind that gap and letting others, when you have the great privilege of having people look at your work, fill it in, it's a great opportunity to really see the potential of what you've created and the mysteries and intrigues that could be wrapped in it that you couldn't previously see.
For getting some quick, I guess, inspiration for things that you could use, especially from the Elder Scrolls,
most of the books, I'd say probably just about all of them that are in the games, are online. You can find them at UESP.net. You can find them at UESP.net. Realize I said that too fast. And or the Imperial Library.
A quick ICUP. Wait.
No. I knew you had cameras, but you have to look through them and just kind of appreciate some of the books that are in there. And one of the ones that I definitely do is The Wolf Queen, which is this story that takes place in, I think, like 200 years or so before Oblivion and Morrowind. And it has nothing to do with any of the storylines. Nothing. It's about a civil war for the throne of the Empire. And it's really interesting how they tie everything together and how it adds depth to four or five different places just by being this like little short story about a civil war that, while it's an interesting story, has nothing to actually do with the story of the games they're in. So they don't define that story. They just help make the world feel just a little bit larger. And coming up with something like that for your own work, in my opinion, and in having been an inspiration of my own, it really does kind of help you feel like the world is just like that little bit bigger and your history that little bit deeper every time you do something like that. And you don't have to write a 20,000 word short story. It can be just a couple paragraphs, a page of just, this is what happened, and you have something.
Yeah, I think something that is fascinating about games like Elder Scrolls, the Elder Scrolls series, that lets you dive into their background lore at your leisure is very fascinating, and something that I think we all can learn from a world-building perspective. And like you just said, you don't have to go out and write a 20,000-word short story to explore the background of your world or the stories that they tell in it. Oftentimes, just having on paper some things that people, stories that people would tell each other or would read about, really helps flesh out that background. And it also makes it so that sits in the back of your mind that when you're writing out your characters and stuff like that, that sits back there and you think, well, you know, he may have read this story, so I'm going to, you know, just drop this little detail in there. And it makes everything seem so much more alive that way. I cannot emphasize enough how much fun that is to do, to just sit down and say, this is something I want to play with, and to fill in those empty spaces in your world's history. Granted, you know, that stuff may never see the light of day. The only reason Elder Scrolls can get away with having that stuff present is because it's an optional side thing. You can go and read The Wolf Queen in its entirety. It's been in the series since Morrowind. Just because it's not something the audience will ever actually see doesn't mean it's of no value to you as a world builder. And that's one of the really cool things that I think you can take away from this episode is that there are, you know, a billion ways to skin a cat to make your world feel much more alive. Go and explore those things. Find what you like about different ways that you've seen lore handled in different media. And see how you can replicate that for yourself, regardless of being in a different media altogether. I mean, I'm writing short stories. I don't really intend to make a game anytime soon, but having those just side stories is something that's really important to me, because I think that it helps you grow as someone who sees worlds as being much more deep than we give them credit.
I fully agree. And ironically, I just checked, if you do want to read a 20,000-word short story based in the Elder Scrolls world, look up my favorite book, 2920, The Last Year of the First Era. It's amazing. It adds so much to just about every place in Tamriel, and it takes place something like 1,300 years before the games and has nothing to do with it, once again, but just adds tons and tons and tons of lore.
What's the premise?
The Remen Empire is at its height. Mankind is about to finish conquering Tamriel, and something goes wrong and they don't succeed, and everything crumbles to dust and the second era begins.
Oh, neat. So is it like more of a, like a history, like a narrative? Is it like from, it's like an actual,
it's historical fiction?
It's historical fiction. And there are two Saesi characters, two vampire snake men,
that walk on either this one. They actually walk on tails. They actually only have tails, but there are two of them in there that are characters. Actually, it might be three.
Now, for anyone who may, you know, be listening to this podcast without any knowledge of the Elder Scrolls for some reason, first off, go play an Elder Scrolls game. You owe it to yourself. It's
start with Skyrim. It's easiest.
Skyrim's accessible. It'll make it kind of difficult to go back and play the older ones, to be honest. But yes, it is accessible. It's easy. It's cheap. There are also tons of fun mods for it. But one of the things that Tyler brought up is the difference between the first era and the second era, which this book covers, that transition. Eras in Elder Scrolls are really fascinating. They're just like blocks of time that are determined by super important historical events. So it's kind of a big deal, 2920. It's really cool.
And usually ends with either everything falling apart or coming together. Actually, both odd eras end with everything falling apart, and both even eras have to do with them trying to put them back together.
It's a cycle.
Which is a theme in the Elder Scrolls.
That it is.
Do you guys realize that the world is also a circle?
Well, the world is probably flat.
Wait.
No!
I read a really convincing argument on Facebook about it.
We go for depth here, Tyler. Depth. We can't have a flat earth if we have depth. Does not compute.
I believe in depth in my world building, so round's the only shape for me. Because technically, isn't a cube just six flat sides?
So where were we?
Not wrong.
Cycles, a theme. Cycles. Yeah, cool.
So there is this really cool underlying premise that all of the games, except for Morrowind, you are playing a character known as a Shezarine, the reincarnation, or an incarnation in this case, of Shezar, of Lorcan, of Shor. Three different names for one god. The man, the being, the divine entity responsible for tricking all the gods into staying in reality. Earlier I mentioned Meridia, who's a Magna Gi. They left. Well, they left because Lorcan tricked everyone into starting reality. For this, just about everyone left. Those that didn't, such as our Lord and Savior Akatosh, ripped out Lorcan's heart and shot it across the continent. And he turned to ash. Supposedly his body are the two moons, but that's just Khajiit propaganda. And there's this really neat thing where there are characters that are supposedly Shor's incarnation. People like the aforementioned Pelennor Whitestrake. There's this other, the Underking, who is supposedly one. The second game, Daggerfall, has a lot to do with this concept and talks about it in length. And the reason why the main character has the ending they have in canon is because they are a Shezarine. The idea is that to save humanity, or really more so the world, from being obliterated, Shor, Lorcan, Shezar, they reincarnate themselves so that way they can defend reality and they can stop whatever evil elf plot is going on at the time to end it all. It's no coincidence that the main bad guy of Oblivion is an elf. Just saying. Damn knife ears.
Hey, it's actually, it's kind of fun to see how the Dunmer just get the karmic hammer probably hits them very appropriately throughout the games. Sometimes I feel bad for them, but then you think about how they legitimately treat everyone else in Morrowind. Granted, it's not just them that does that, but they had it coming, I would like to say.
At least in the story, every time the Dunmer do something awful, they get it. They get the karmic hammer for doing it. Like, they got turned into the Dunmer for breaking the one oath that mattered. They then lose their gods in Morrowind. That's the whole plot of the game, is that it's ending. And then, for some reason, actually, not really making any good sense other than we're never going back here and now we're definitively destroying it, most of Morrowind gets ruined by a meteorite impact.
So while there is an ending there in Morrowind, technically the cycle of the Dunmer just getting the ups and downs or trying to make do with what they have doesn't really end. Another thing about it, I never finished the Dragonborn DLC. Don't you technically go back to Do you go back to Morrowind?
You go to Solstheim.
You go to the
Island of Solstheim, which is the location for Blood Moon, one of the second expansion for Morrowind. It's like an island right on the border of Morrowind and Skyrim.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which Solstheim's really cool because it has this mix of Nord and Dark Elf architecture and culture, and has this own unique little subsect of the Nords that live there and have their own little village and their own little culture. And man, they're just like Scottish Eskimos. It's really weird.
I never thought anyone would ever say that. But now that you mention it, yes, that is a fantastic way to describe how they managed to make Solstheim feel kind of because I felt kind of like, oh, this is kind of like Morrowind, but then it's like, oh, they're still kind of Nordic. So again, bringing in that that blending of cultures at that borderline, it's good that they managed to kind of keep at it, all things considering, because it was a long, long time between Morrowind and the Dragonborn DLC for Skyrim.
And werewolves, man. They brought in werewolves.
Well, I mean, Skyrim already had werewolves.
Yeah, but Solstheim's got its own little, like, thing going.
Yeah.
Lore-wise.
Skyrim had Beastie Boys. They didn't have werewolves until Dragonborn.
But the Companions quest line, you turn into a werewolf.
I know. That was a joke. Because it was like, they were just going beast mode.
Well, we're just going to brush past that.
I tried.
You didn't go to Falkreath. You didn't do Ill Met by Moonlight, which is one of the best quests out there. So you don't get to talk about werewolves.
And I did that one. It just took a while.
Took one look at those hovels and I left disappointed.
I did complete every quest that was not a raiding quest at a certain point. That's probably why.
Ill Met by Moonlight is a pretty quick one, but it requires a ton of travel is the problem. But you do get the OP ability to turn into a werewolf as many times a day as you want.
It's pretty cool.
It is super nice. Super cool.
Okay. From here, I think we shall take a quick talk about just how the game shows you its lore. And that'll kind of wrap us up for our quick dissection. So basically the games and the setting itself is shown to you in a few different ways, even within the games themselves. Like there is the books that are in every game that you can go around and read, these in-game lore books. They are written as if they are in the world. There are just small comments made about places by characters in the game. Like, not like, it's not a quest, you don't go there. It's just this small, quick thing. Like, in Oblivion, you can overhear people talking about how in the Somerset Isles, the High Elves there that live there enslave goblins as servants, which is just kind of weird when you think about how many goblins you kill in Oblivion, going, wait, these guys have, you could do that? You can actually stop them from being this way? But I guess we'll let them live in their caves, miserable, killing people. there are the pocket guides to the Empire, which were out-of-game books printed by Bethesda. I know that one of them comes in the collector's edition of Oblivion, and I think the other one came with Redguard, which was the game before Morrowind, but not really an Elder Scrolls game. It was like an Elder Scrolls version of Tomb Raider. It actually has a really cool storyline.
Skyrim's got one too. I think they've done it with every special edition for them, for their mainline games at least. Because it gets updated every entry, which is also really cool because, you know, every entry is at a different point in time.
Yeah, and it's this really cool little book that, like Red said, it gets updated with a little bit more accurate lore in each one. And it gives you a lot of... Sorry, I'm laughing. They give you an entire rundown on the people's history, the history of the province, what was there before, if anything, what's there, some cities and some lore about them. It's just really this neat little document that ties everything together, and it's actually sizable. It's not tiny, but it's not huge, so you can definitely get through it rather quickly, and it has beautiful illustrations in it. So definitely worth checking them out if you want to know more. It's definitely a great primer for the setting. Further from that, The Elder Scrolls does this really interesting thing, in my opinion, in that the story of the games generally give you no lore. There might be a few tidbits to tie the actual action together,
like some things in Morrowind that tie why you're killing Mirun's Dagon and who the Neverine is. But otherwise, it doesn't really tell you about Morrowind. You have to find out about Morrowind, which is one of the points of the game. But all of them kind of do that. Oblivion doesn't really show you the lore. It kind of just explains, yeah, there was a liminal barrier protecting us from Oblivion, and now it's broken, and a giant red angry guy is kind of come and kill us.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that, again, contributes to the story accessibility of these games to some extent. It is also kind of a letdown in a way, because you're like, man, for us diehard, you know, lore people, we're like, man, I want some more lore. This would be great. You know, work that stuff in, make it matter to my character a little. But it's interesting because they never give you more information than you really need. I mean, for instance, I think the most they really give you in Skyrim is that the Empire is, you know, banished Talos worship, and that is pretty much it. Dragons used to be dead, and they've come back, and that's pretty much it. You know, there's just these little tidbits of information that you need in order to understand what's going on, but like nothing more than that. They don't force you to understand where you are, what you are, or, you know, where you're headed, really, beyond this is what you need to know right now for this to make any sense. Enjoy. Which, again, it's kind of disappointing to some extent, but at the same time, too, is kind of a smart move on their part to make this really accessible. And it doesn't kind of put you, like Immokinate was saying earlier, on that railroad.
Yeah, and I think what the other part of it is that the game kind of pre-establishes what's going on and where you are, and you have to find that information on your own. But once you do, everything in the world and the quest lines, it takes place there, and it makes sense, and it's not far-fetched, and you just, every little bit immerses you more into what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I really like that approach where it kind of shows itself by those who dare explore it.
Right, and they definitely weren't, Bethesda's not the first company in the world to make lore optional, but the way that they've handled it has proven to be really solid.
I think it also helps that the game has replayability, part of it because it's very smooth mechanics for the time, and despite its age at this point, with the advent of community created additions, modifications to the game, it's still has a lot of that replayability. And I think that's something that we're starting to see, I don't want to say see, oh gosh, this might be too much of a generalization. I like seeing games that active play style that encourages players to just play and inserting the bits of lore without them realizing you're actually being kind of exposed to a world. The only other thing the one that comes to mind to me is like Dark Souls tends to do that, but it's not nearly as overt, I would say, even compared to the Elder Scrolls especially.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that level almost to say they do more atmospheric world building, whereas Elder Scrolls gives you the option and kind of hits you in the face with this is what's going on because this is your quest. This is what's in your journal, this is what you got to do, and there are all these supplementary resources, books, NPCs, of course, online guides outside the game that can help you flesh out what you're experiencing. And if you choose to return to it, you'll have that level of depth to that experience added on.
Yeah, and you never feel bad about passing on a quest line, even when it does get thrown at you. Like when you first enter, what is it, Markarth, and the Forsworn guy just goes and randomly kills someone in the market. It's like they basically are throwing it in your face. They're like, there's something going on here. You might want to go check it out. But you can completely bypass that and just go, no, I'm good. And move on with your life like every other citizen in the city does. But that is the cool thing. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, Markarth does that to you a lot. Think about it.
Yeah, yeah. That's hardly the only quest in there that tries to do that. It is a really fascinating way to do that, and that's something you can only really get away with in video games. You can't make an optional section of a book. I guess you could. You could be the first person to do that. If you do it successfully, let me know. I'd really like to read that book.
Goosebumps?
And not just Choose Your Own Adventure or Goosebumps stuff. But like,
darn.
I guess technically those count, but not really. But it's just, it's a really fascinating way to handle that, is to let the players choose what they want to be interested in. Not just in terms of the background historic lore, but also the current, the contemporary stuff. So, you know, you have this really, really big quest thrown right in your face, but you can choose to ignore it if you want. And that kind of also lends this weird breathability to the world as well. You don't feel swamped by that stuff if that's not what you're interested in, but it is also present for you to enjoy.
Indeed. Where's my Skyrim tabletop?
Oh, you mean that horrible thing that they put out that was just copying someone else?
Oh, no. I didn't even bring that up. But no, it's essentially what Red was highlighting is kind of the essence of why I think there's this surge of people interested in campaigns that take place in the world that have choice and lore, but as well as the player directive to how much they indulge in that and allowing them to kind of see what they want to see and then just pass by. Though often as a it's harder to give the same depth and level experience for one person as a DM or a GM to replicate what you do in a video game. And so I think that's where we get those kind of sliding scales of direction, of guidance. Some would say the railroad versus the sandbox, sandbox dilemma, because video games can be a sandbox, if at least by comparison to what any one person can pull off in a tabletop role-playing game.
It's just, for something that's kind of essentially mass-produced and shipped out for people, it's hard to have that player tie and that essentially for something that is mass-produced, it's hard to have that essentially player-tailored experience to be consistently shown. Like it's hard to, I think, get something like that out, especially when you're trying to take into account graphics and mechanics like Skyrim has versus something like...
Oh, and
like,
marketability.
Yeah. Versus something like a lot
of times we like to throw them under the bus because we feel that they're, you know, they're like doing this just for money, but there are some passionate people on that team. You can't forget.
There were, and now there's just people who ported over to Oculus Rift and
yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess it's not exactly a catch-all statement there. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. like to be optimistic in this part of my life.
Do you have a Switch? Because, never mind.
No, I forgot. No.
Wait, what's happening now? What?
There's a port for it on the Switch.
For Skyrim.
Oh, yeah, but that's been around forever.
Yeah.
I'm waiting to be able to play it on my smart fridge. It's a total lie. I don't have a smart fridge.
I mean,
if I had one, I'd want to play Skyrim on it.
Oh my God. I only have a smart toaster.
Why does a toaster need to be smart?
Because I don't want burnt toast, Dino. What's wrong with you?
That's what the dial's for.
Oh, wait, Tyler. What's wrong with you, Tyler?
Does that number actually even do anything, though?
Yeah,
it's like the dial they used to put on razors. It's like, what does this really even do?
It's literally a timer. It's what I've discovered. Yeah. Like in most recent ones, we're getting sidetracked, but it just kind of activates it when you turn on the timer on the toaster.
All right, I think us talking about toasters is a call for last thoughts. Unless you had something else to bring up. That's Elder Scrolls related and not smart toaster related.
I want to think of Elder Scrolls and kind of the collaborative effort. It's like a chunk of Swiss cheese. There's a lot of holes to it sometimes, but when you get down and slice it and you put it on some nice bread of utter lore and the player experience and the games, it makes a delicious, delicious experience. A delicious sandwich experience. But bad metaphors aside, the Elder Scrolls does great with working inconsistencies into the narrative experience for anyone that's reading it, whether they be players or readers, or I guess people who like watching lore videos on YouTube. It's playing into the idea that sometimes you can't always account for everything in the world. But when you have enough and you leave enough connections for people to pick up on and possibly make on their own, it does make something that's memorable and something that people talk about, and something that maybe someone as a creator or part of the team that created it can also spin into more than what they had initially intended. And there's a certain beauty in making use of ambiguity like that.
Yeah, I don't have a cheesy metaphor for you guys. Oh boy, but I apparently have an unintentional cheesy pun. But for me, I love that we finally had a chance to talk about his setting in depth a bunch here, because it's fun to see all these principles that we talk about here on the podcast in a light of them being applied somewhere. And even some of the things that we've talked about being broken and how you can work with those. If you've never, again, I said this earlier, if you've never played an Elder Scrolls game, or if you've just never looked into Elder Scrolls lore, those are two things that I can't recommend enough, if you're into that sort of thing. It's a really prime example of what you can do with world building when you give it enough time. You may not be a part of a team of people, and you may not be working on your setting for 30 years like these guys are, but you can still use the principles that they have shown in their work here to better your ability to world build for settings and stories that you want to tell. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. We've got a lot of people here on the World Building Magazine server who constantly say that they're afraid of, you know, moving too far forward with one idea, just in case, you know, it might devastate some plan that they have down the road. But if there's one major thing that you can take away from Elder Scrolls, is it's that there is always a way to make it work in really fun and fascinating ways sometimes. Maybe you do have to retcon something down the road, but that is just fine. Accept that fact and, you know, really figure out how you can make yourself enjoy the mistakes, because you're going to make them. It's an inevitability. But there's always a really bright future on the corner if you're really passionate about the project that you're into.
Personally, one of the things that I love to take away from the Elder Scrolls is that your setting never has to be one thing. It never has to be stuck to one genre, to one idea, to one motif. The Elder Scrolls is Romans in the jungle. It is giant golems deleting things from reality. It is questing knights and people sleeping on magic stone tablets to learn katana slices that break reality. It is human and it is alien and it is gods who are there and gods who are not. It is everything that you could possibly think of crammed together and given this life, because it just tries to treat everything as genuine. It doesn't shy away from racism. It doesn't shy away from hard talks and war and brutality, but it doesn't have nothing but that. It has beauty and funny moments and people turning invisible so that way they can watch the ones they love go about their day. It is so much more than just fantasy, and that's what you should take away. So I'll leave you with a quote from my favorite book in the Elder Scrolls universe. It's actually one of the last quotes. In the smoky catacombs beneath the city where Sotha Sill forged the future with his arcane clockwork apparatus, something unforeseen happened. An oily bubble seeped from a long trusted gear and popped. Immediately, the wizard's attention was drawn to it, into the chain that the tiny action triggered. A pipe shifted half an inch to the left. A tread skipped. A coil rewound itself and began spinning in a counter direction. A piston that had been thrusting left-right for millennia suddenly began shifting right-left. Nothing broke, but everything changed.
You've been tuned into Worldcasting, an affiliate production of Worldbuilding Magazine. Have any feedback, comments, questions, or concerns? You can get in touch with us on our website, worldbuildingmagazine.com. There you can find links to our social media, or feel free to come chat with us on the World Building Magazine Discord server. Thanks for listening to Worldcasting, and until next week, keep worldbuilding.